What's going on, everybody? My name is Larry Francis, but you know me better on Instagram as A Wrestling Historian. And today on To Be Determined, I have my guest with me. He is former WWE creative team member George Rutherford. How you doing today, sir?
I'm great, Larry. Thanks.
Well, I appreciate you reaching out to me on Instagram. I never really talked to anybody before from the creative team, so I'm glad to have you on the show.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I follow a few different wrestling Instagram pages, and yours came up as a suggestion, and I started following it and really just loved the page. And one day you had posted about Undertaker and Batista in a steel cage match on free TV on SmackDown that was near and dear to me, and I told my girlfriend, hey, you know, this is that match that I was telling you about. And she said, hey, you know, you should comment and let him know. So I did, and we got in touch, and here we are. So it was fortuitous. I'm very happy to be here.
Very cool. So for all the listeners out there, could you give us an abridged version of your life story?
I grew up a wrestling fan. I mean, I'm 41, so I definitely grew up in the Hulkamania era. I had all of the old, you know, LJN rubber, not posable toys, and Saturday Night's Main Event, and you know, all of that good stuff. And when I joined the Navy in 1996, I kind of fell out of it for a while just because it was tough to keep up. This was, you know, really, the internet was in its infancy, so it was hard to, you know, kind of be overseas and keep up with wrestling. So I got out in 2000 and then got interested again.
How'd you get your job at World Wrestling Entertainment?
I heard through a friend of mine. I was working in independent film in Pittsburgh, and just through some friends I had in the film scene, it was recommended to me that I should, you know, apply to be a writer for WWE, that they were accepting applications for writers. So I went on the website and submitted a writing sample, and based on the strength of that sample, I got called in for an interview. So I drove from Pennsylvania to WWE headquarters in Stamford, and which is interesting because I was stationed in Connecticut when I was in the Navy. So I used to drive past and see Titan Towers a lot, and, you know, like, everybody thought, gee, I wonder what it would be like. Well, I had my chance. So I went up and I interviewed with a guy named John Weiner, who I still am connected with on LinkedIn all these years later. This was 2007. Interviewed with him, got called back up a second time, interviewed with the head of human resources. I can't remember her name. Then went up a third time and interviewed with Michael P.S. Hayes, who was the head writer of SmackDown at the time. And then the fourth time was come up, basically get the once over from Vince. Vince asked me one question. The question was, why should I hire you? If you put a gun to my head right now, I could not tell you what I said. It was basically a blur. Without barely looking up from his desk, Vince looked over and said, hire him. And that was it. So it was pack my bags, I'm moving to Connecticut. And I got up there and started my orientation. And it was a Raiders brawl at the time, who, of course, I know what a fan you are of Jim Cornette. Kurt Bauer now has Major League Wrestling, where Cornette works. But Kurt Bauer was a writer for Raw at the time, and the first thing he told me is, this is not the real world. And he was 100% right.
Do you remember what match got you into wrestling?
Boy, that's tough. I mean, I have specific memories of the first WrestleMania, but I don't think, and I know this is so cliche, but if I had to really name the one that just put me over Andre at WrestleMania 3, I was old enough to remember that one pretty clearly. And just seeing that crowd at the Silver Dome and Hogan slamming Andre, and at the time, you know, as a kid thinking that that was impossible, it had never been done before. Of course, it had been done before, but they just said it hadn't. And, you know, being too young to realize a leg drop wouldn't really do that much, it just seemed amazing at the time. And that was it. I mean, it was... I was hooked. I was hooked from that point. And I would have to say, though, all in all, I probably loved heels and anti-heroes more, and I definitely thought that those were the more interesting characters to write for. But I was a kid in the 80s, man. You had to love Hulk. But yeah, that would probably be it.
What made you go to school to get a degree in writing?
I went for speech communication, interpersonal communication, public speaking. But while I was in college, I had seen that there were open auditions for an independent film, a World War II film. And the only acting I'd ever done was in school, drama club type stuff, and didn't really have any experience, but I've always been a, you can't win if you don't play. Type of person. So I went down to this audition with no experience up against 12 other guys for an ensemble. It was an ensemble cast, so there were five leads, and this was for one of the leads. And I auditioned and actually got the part. So it was through doing that film, which led to doing a TV pilot that sadly didn't get picked up. A web series that I just got to know people and get really involved and practice writing and practice the creative process and network, and that is ultimately what led to going to WWE.
I'm surprised to hear that, because WWE makes it so difficult to even be considered, because you have to meet all these prerequisites, and apparently you were able to skip all that to get in your position.
Well, you know, something that my old debate coach used to tell us in college was, if you can't dazzle them with brilliance, befuddle them with bullshit. I mean, I had crammed together a decent amount of a resume in a relatively short period of time. I had been working as a staff writer for a website called whatculture.com at that point, and had a good number of articles, a lot of them about wrestling. Some of them have been turned into YouTube videos. There is a What Culture video on YouTube right now about an article I did that was 9 things you learn as a WWE creative writer, you know, that I ended up doing afterwards. So I'd been working for What Culture at that point and had written some scripts that had been turned into different projects. So, like I said, even though I didn't go to school for it, once I got involved, I really hit the ground running and put together a decent body of work in a matter of a few years. And I think I interviewed well, because they made me drive up there 4 times. So if I didn't interview well, I don't think I would have made it that far.
How long did the hiring process take?
Oh, it was a long time. I mean, it was months. I would, like, after the first call, it was 3 weeks between the first call and the first trip up there. And then, you know, weeks would go by. So it was, I don't remember exactly, but it was a lengthy process. And once I finally did start, it's amazing the process. I'm sitting there by myself in orientation. There's no class of new hires. It's just me. I'm sitting there with this very professional lady who's from Human Resources, and she's explaining, you know, just different policies and procedures like you would any company, and then she starts breaking down expectations creative team member, and is telling me, now listen, the talent, they are used to being on the road, they're used to being able to party and drink and get 3 hours of sleep and then get up the next day and perform. You are not. If you go out and drink all night and are hungover and can't perform, you'll lose your job. So, because for those who don't know, the creative team, we're not a separate entity. We're with the talent. We are in the same planes, trains, and automobiles with them. We're in the same hotels. We travel with them. So, human resources is telling me, when you're out with the talent, order clear liquor drinks. Because then you can take your drink to the bathroom, dump it out, fill your glass with water, and drink water all night. That's the only way you'll survive. I'm being told this by human resources in new hire orientation. It's surreal. I mean, what other company is human resources telling you? Get clear liquor drinks and dump it out and fill it up with water. But it's good advice. I will tell you that, because you're not drinking those guys under the table or even coming close to keeping up with them. So it was good advice.
Which superstars were difficult for you to work with?
For me, with my experience, overall the talent were very cool. The only two people who kind of came off, I don't even want to call them assholes, because I understand that, you know, you got a job to do and there's a lot of pressure and all that kind of stuff. Bruce Pritchard was a little rough. And it kind of bummed me out because, I always enjoyed his gimmick as Brother Love. And I always enjoyed Bruce Pritchard as a creative, you know, part of the team. But he's a little rough on the new guys, but nothing compared to JBL. JBL makes no bones about it whatsoever. First time meeting JBL, and let me rewind a bit. There's certain... How do I put this? There's certain expectations, like sort of subcultural expectations within the WWE community. So as a new person, you're expected to go up and introduce yourself to talent, call them by their wrestling name unless they tell you otherwise, shake their hand. You know, it's not their job to introduce themselves to you, it's your job to introduce yourselves to them, and that's expected. And if you don't, people view you as being kind of an antisocial, you know, jerk. So every time I would see a talent that I hadn't met, I would walk up, hello, my name is George, put my hand out. So I see JBL. I walk up, JBL, how you doing? My name is George, new writer for SmackDown. And he looks at me and he goes, hold on. He takes his phone out, and he says, stand there. And he takes my picture. And he says, okay, you're going to be, and I can't remember if it was Dickhead or Shithead, but it was, you're going to be Dickhead number 16. And if you look, there was a whole bunch of pictures of people, just their face, and then Dickhead number 1 through 15, and they were just new WWE employees, and he would take their picture, assign them a number, and then basically take an over-under on how long he thought they would last. And he was like, okay, Dickhead number 16, I'm giving you 2 weeks. I don't think you're going to make it 2 weeks. That was my introduction to JBL. So you can be sure that on day 15, I could not wait to see JBL just to let him know that I beat the over-under on his two-week bet on how long I would make it. But that was it. That was about the worst experience I had with a talent. Like I said, everybody was pretty cool. And, I mean, I can't even take it personally. From what I understand, JBL's kind of that way with almost everybody. So, it is what it is. And by and large, though, it was a very positive experience with everybody. I mean, in contrast, first time meeting Mr. Kennedy in an airport, as I walked up to shake his hand, he gave me a big smile, picked me up, gave me a hug and kissed me on the cheek. That was how I met him. So you never know what you're going to get from people.
What was your experience with Dusty Rhodes?
At the time, Dusty Rhodes was the head wrestler. writer for ECW, and I absolutely adore Dusty. I mean, he, you know, God rest his soul, Dusty was every bit the gentleman, the mentor, the nice guy that you would hope he would be. One time, I'm in the writer's room. So the writer's room is, it's on the top floor of Titan Tower, and there's no windows. You know, you figure if you got like a square building, the writer's room is in the center of the top floor, so there are no windows. There's two doors, there's a front door and a back door. They're both locked at all times. There are even screens that get pulled down over the whiteboards in there, so when the custodial staff are cleaning, you can cover the whiteboards and they can't see what's written. So they do take it very seriously. So one day it's just Dusty and I. And, I mean, this is how many wrestling fans have the opportunity to get Dusty Rhodes alone where you can just annoy him with questions, which I was going to do. But he took it in stride. Like I said, he was a great guy. And, you know, we were talking about kayfabe and how it was back then versus how it is now. He told me, and I can't do it justice unless you do it as Dusty, but he says, let me tell you something, young fella. The day that the wrestling business reached the point that it could never go back from was the day that Vincent McMahon went on television and told everybody that it was just sports entertainment during the steroid scandal. And, you know, Dusty really broke it down. He said, you know, before, you could have someone hold a guy in a headlock and do that for 5 minutes, building drama and tension, while really you're just catching your breath. You could, you know, you could utilize a lot more ring psychology when people still could suspend their disbelief. Once Vince went on television and told everybody it was sports entertainment, you couldn't fool the crowd with a 3 minute, 5 minute headlock anymore. It's okay, I know you're not really choking him, so do something else. Jump off of something higher, do backflips, go through tables, light something on fire. You know, more. And, you know, and so Dusty explained, it created a different kind of superstar. It required people with more physical and athletic ability, even if they didn't necessarily have the charisma, the personality, or the ring psychology to be the type of person that could have been a superstar in the 80s and 90s. So, you know, Dusty was just a great wealth of information, a great wealth of stories, and just a sweetheart of a guy, and he was great, and I'm just really sad that he's gone, but really feel very fortunate that I had the opportunity to work with him.
What was the best advice he gave you?
Oh, my God. Best advice Dusty Rhodes ever gave me. It's relatively common advice, but it was very applicable for that setting. And he said, figure out where your best lane is and stay in it. Because in this business, anytime you step out of your lane without knowing all the angles, you're probably going to step on someone's foot, and that's just going to cause drama for you. So figure out where you fit and make that work. And I think that that is good advice, because I would see guys fall victim to that. It's tough. I mean, there's a real appeal to that life. And even if you're not a talent, you step in that ring and it's intoxicating. Even if you know you're not going to be wrestling in it, even if you know your name's not going to be on TV, you step in that ring, it's intoxicating. But you got to remember who you are, and you have to remember your role. I got a few on-screen appearances. Sometimes I would just be like, you know, guy in the hallway backstage when a fight breaks out. And, you know, I think one time I was carrying a stack of papers and Carlito came and just knocked them out of my hand, you know, like that sort of thing. But the one semi-regular role I had was as a paparazzi for Melina. because the gimmick that we had for Melina, obviously, is that she was this movie star, and they would roll out the red carpet, and she would walk to the ring and have two paparazzi with her. Well, Rick Garney and I were two of the paparazzi. And if you watch the video for Backlash from 2007, I get, a solid like 10 seconds of camera time on there. So, of course, that's very exciting for me. But Dusty said, you know, appreciate that. That's a nice bonus. But be the best writer you can be. Don't worry about, you know, how you can worm your way into more on-screen time. Prove your abilities. Doing what it is you're supposed to do.
Melina Perez has a reputation for being difficult. Is that true or false?
I will say this. Melina definitely had a reputation for being difficult with other girls. Melina was nothing but sweet with me. She never argued or complained about anything creative to me or that I heard of. The biggest issue with Melina, honestly, at that time was just kind of relationship drama, because that was when she and Johnny Nitro were a couple, but then word was that Batista was, you know, I mean, I knew the rumors, I didn't really know the details, but that was the biggest thing with her. She was never problematic to me. We had her in a program with Mickey James for a while, and the two of them worked together very well. I mean, Mickey was another one. She was just an absolute sweetheart, always positive, always, like, Mickey was great, because Mickey would be all, you know, dolled up for her match, but behind the scenes, Mickey was just this nerdy little fangirl who would, you know, the sneakers that have the roller skate wheels built into them? She would have those on and just be cruising around with her glasses on and her little roller sneakers on backstage, and then when it was showtime, she would get turned into Mickey James. But yeah, they were both very down to earth. Like I said, the Divas, I did a lot of work, because, you know, being a, no offense to the ladies, women's wrestling wasn't the same in 2007 that it is now. They were not main eventing WrestleMania. So as a new writer, I was given a lot of creative assignments for the Divas, because that just at the time wasn't considered as high priority. But I thought it was a great experience. The ladies were cool. They were a lot of fun. Like I said, they were nice to me. I don't know if it's because they felt they had to, because they didn't want anything bad creatively to happen, but the only one that I got the impression wasn't thrilled with what was happening at the time was Cherry with Deuce and Domino. But even then, she never outwardly complained.
What was your schedule like?
I mean, it depended. It was, you figure, at the time, SmackDown was pre-taped. So Monday, we were live for Raw. Tuesday, you know, we were TV Monday, we're taping Tuesday. So you'd have Wednesday, Thursday, maybe in the office. Friday, we're typically on the road. Might be home that weekend, but I mean, we're on the road 300 days out of the year. So when we're in the office, you're in the creative room. And that's the thing, too, is you get hired for a certain team, like Raw, SmackDown, or ECW, but there was so much overlap. You know, and it's one big writer's room. So you're all in there together, and you're all pitching ideas together, and sometimes the Raw guys would do their own thing, the SmackDown guys would do their own thing. But it was a lot of what is called backwards chaining, which is how professional wrestling storylines are written, at least in the WWE. The whole point is to make it look like what you're seeing on TV is in the moment and organic, but you're always beginning with the end in mind. So you're always thinking about, okay, for SmackDown, what is our big match in WrestleMania going to look like? Okay, once we figure out what that's going to be, now we're going to figure out what are going to be the matches in the big four pay-per-views that are going to build to that. And once we, you know, once we're the Big Four, including WrestleMania. So, you know, Survivor Series, Royal Rumble, SummerSlam, and WrestleMania. Once we have our Big Four figured out, now let's figure out what we're going to put in the smaller pay-per-views. And then we're going to get sort of a loose narrative on what we're going to have on TV that's going to build to that. So ultimately, everything we do is with the mindset of building toward WrestleMania. If you think about it, it's a lot like football. You know, those tryouts and practices and pre to the Super Bowl, same thing. Now people have asked me, well, if you plan, you need the writers to be on the road with them. It's already figured out. Hired, people get hurt, new people get hired, you know, great frequency. So there were times where an hour and a half before going on live TV changes and match changes, that diversion to take a very long loop to get you to the path that you started on, so your pay-per-view events. So it's a lot. And again, the job is to make it look seamless, and I think Chris has done that with varying degrees of success. Sometimes it looks very planned out. Sometimes it's very predictable. And sometimes, even now, knowing what I know, knowing how the sausage is made, I can still watch something and go, holy shit, I did not see that coming. And that's what I like. I like when something happens that takes me by surprise. Because for a while, I could watch the product and know who wrote it based on what happened. Because different writers tend to have certain fingerprints in how they write. So I enjoy when something new happens. But average days were production meeting, a lot of sitting down and grinding out storylines, a lot of getting on the phone with talent, a lot of fielding calls from talent. That actually happened a lot more than people would expect. Getting phone calls from, your second and third tier superstars who would have an idea for a gimmick or how they wanted something to go, and they would just call and want to pitch it to the creative team. And, you know, that's where it would become kind of a delicate balance as well, because you don't want to alienate or piss off the talent, but if you took every single one of their ideas, everybody would be the heavyweight champion. So it's an interesting balancing act of keeping the talent as happy as you can, which is, again, varying degrees of success, putting out the best product possible, but at the end of the day, it's all about what's Vince going to go for. Because I can tell you, at least as of when I was there, everything had to go through Vince. Stephanie was the head of creative, but even still, everything went through Vince. And Vince was very hands-on, and he wanted to be involved. So yeah, it was a very fast-paced environment. But yeah, I'm not sure there is such a thing as a typical day, because you never knew what you were going to field. It could be a certain talent who might be related to Cowboy Bob Orton, partied a little too hard, and passed out in catering. And now you got to figure out what to do because he can't wrestle that night. It might be somebody trashed a hotel room and got sent home, and now you got to figure out what to do. So it was just always that kind of thing. Just, you never knew what to expect.
How long did your creative meetings usually last?
Production meetings could go anywhere from 30 minutes, typically no more than an hour, because production meetings are happening on site at the arena. So you didn't really want to drag it out too much. So, you know, we tended to make them all killer, no filler. There wasn't a lot of time for just BS. There was absolutely no chit-chatting. But here's a good example of the types of things that get ironed out in production meetings. So, I feel bad, I can't remember the kid's name. But there was a young boy who, through the Make-A-Wish Foundation, was going to be on TV. And, you know, his make-a-wish, this, he wanted to go to WWE and meet the wrestlers and everything. So someone had the idea, let's really make this kid's wish. Let's make him the general manager for the night. Okay, that's a great feel-good thing. Prompt this kid, give him some easy prompts that couldn't really mess up. And, you know, let this kid be the GM. The thing was, the main event that night was going to be a fatal four-way match. Now, this kid was suffering from, you know, awful disease. So, in the production meeting, someone, I think it might have been John Carl, raises his hand and says, do we really want to have this Make-A-Wish kid announcing a fatal four-way? And Vince goes, God damn it. So they end up just changing it from a fatal four-way to, like, a four-man battle royale, just so this Make-A-Wish kid didn't have to say fatal four-way on TV. So, I mean, it would just be things like that, even, that just you didn't think about until you were there. And it, like I said, it was always interesting. It could be that. There were times where I would get cornered by talent before going into a production meeting, and, you know, they would just try to get me to go in there and pitch something for them. But it's tough because, again, if you're the type of person that the folks, you know, like Vince, Stephanie, Hunter, Bruce Pritchard, all those guys, they know well enough to know if you're a new writer that got manipulated by a talent and you're just coming in and being a mouthpiece for a talent, like, they know it. So you can't just go in there because Eugene wants to be something other than a mentally handicapped guy. You know, if you're going in there and just advocating for Eugene, they're going to know it. So, like, you just have to have your creative integrity and go in there and pitch what you know is the best product. And sometimes it'll be used, a lot of times it won't. Most of the time, a bastardized version of it will make its way onto TV, which happened more often than not. So, like, a piece of what you pitched would get used, but it would be changed all around, and you just can't personalize it and roll with the punches. And ultimately, the payoff is when the live product happens and you see the crowd react.
What was your best storyline that made on TV?
It would have been the steel cage match with Undertaker and Batista. That's the one I was most proud of. Edge had Money in the Bank. It was originally supposed to go Mr. Kennedy, but Kennedy had gotten injured. Undertaker was also hurt, and Undertaker needed to go out for surgery. He was in bad shape. His bicep was torn. His knee was really bad, so he basically just patched himself up and was going to do, you know, one match before going out for surgery. And we were trying to think of what to do. Kennedy was hurt. Undertaker had to go out. We were planning on having the big match on a pay-per-view, but Undertaker wasn't going to make it that far. So I suggested, and I thought that I would be run out of town on a rail for even bringing it up, but I said, why don't we do Batista and Undertaker on free TV? Make it the last half of SmackDown, you know, give the fans a little treat. We can have Edge cash Money in the Bank come out, you know, have the classic steel cage match finish, both guys' feet hit the ground at the same time. Undertaker retains the title. He just had a brutal match with Batista. And as soon as he retains the title, Edge comes out, cashes Money in the Bank, spears Undertaker, 1, 2, 3. Undertaker can go get surgery and recover and set up a program between Edge and Batista. I know it's probably not a great business move, but as a fan, I really liked the idea of, and again, you wouldn't want to do this all the time, but I really liked the idea of giving the fans, especially, this pay-per-views are expensive. You know, there are a lot of people that just don't really get the opportunity to see pay-per-views. So I liked giving people a pay-per-view main event match on free TV, and no one knew it was going to happen. It was just a really nice surprise. And I will tell you, in a fanboy moment, that was one of the few matches that I didn't just watch. I came out and sat up front. There are some seats up front that, you know, we can use. And I went up front and actually watched that match, you know, down close, because I was very proud of what we managed to pull together with almost nothing. I was very impressed that The Undertaker, who basically had a bad arm and a bad leg, went out there, and you would have never known he was hurt. And I don't know, sometimes you just get that magic time. Like, some matches just have it, and that had it.
The funny thing about that match is the finish was a draw, but if you go back and you watch the footage, you can clearly see on the camera angle that Undertaker won. That was a botch that nobody caught.
I'll tell you what's funny about that, actually, is I was there when they were taking the footage and manipulating it to make it look like they touched at the same time, but in real life, Undertaker clearly landed first. But that's the thing people don't understand. You know how hard it would be to choreograph being on two opposite sides of a steel cage and having your feet touch at the exact same time? It, almost impossible. I have to use some TV magic to make that work. And even still, it's just... But yeah, you're absolutely right. Undertaker's feet hit first. But, you know what, though? People are getting a pay-per-view main event on free TV, so nobody cared. But, you know, that's what's funny, though, about Undertaker. Undertaker was he was a unique guy in a lot of ways, in that, creatively, he was the one person who... You didn't pitch anything or try to get anything involving him on TV without consulting with him first. And it wasn't because he was arrogant, it wasn't because he was a prima donna, it's because he had that respect from everybody, including Vince. You know, anything that was going to be done with The Undertaker got Undertaker's approval first. Now, that really wasn't done with Hunter and Shawn, because Hunter and Shawn were so involved in the creative process anyway that you didn't really have to do that with them, because they were there for it. So, you know, they were involved in that whole thing. But with Undertaker, yeah, you didn't just do something with his character without consulting with him first. He really, you know, Vince was the guy in charge. But on the ground, it was very much The Undertaker. And, you know, things that you hear are true. Undertaker presided over wrestler's court. He was the logical voice of reason in the locker room, and people respected him. And everybody called him Taker. I never heard a single person call him Mark. He was Taker. And again, not because he insisted on it, but because he earned it. He earned that respect, and everybody gave that to him. And out with a torn bicep in a steel cage. You know, and he would do that. And he never complained. And he never bitched. I have a lot of respect for Undertaker.
If it wasn't for his injuries, how long was he supposed to hold the belt for?
I mean, Edge was going to eventually. I don't even remember. Honestly, that was so long ago. I don't remember how long it was supposed to be. But I think, if I remember correctly, it was always going to... Dave, it was just supposed to last longer. Like, it was, we put that on TV. It was supposed to happen at whatever the next, and again, that was years ago, I can't remember the specifics, but whatever the next pay-per-view was, is when that steel cage match was going to happen. But he just couldn't wait that long to get surgery. Like, he was damaged. He needed to be repaired. So we just moved it up a little bit. So it wasn't going to be that much longer. Because again, he figured this was 2007, so Edge was pretty red hot at that time in his heel run, so he was going to get the belt.
Which of the wrestlers were helpful with your job?
Honestly, and I know this isn't real popular to say, but if I didn't say who probably the nicest guy was in the locker room, who was personally the most helpful to me, like, no pun intended, showing me the ropes, was Chris Benoit. You know, he was the one guy who took the time to sit down with me and kind of explain how locker room politics worked. And he's the one who explained to me the expectation to go up and introduce myself to talent and call people by their ring names. And, you know, Benoit was really, really cool, really helpful, and was kind of a go-to guy. Like, I felt very comfortable going to Chris and asking him questions if there was something I didn't know. So it was, it was tough. It was tough when, you know, when that situation with him happened, because, you know, if you'd have told me that something like that was going to happen, I would have never thought it would have been Chris. But there's at least 15 people I could think of that I thought would have had the capacity for that for him. So that was tough. I kind of tuned out for a while after that. I didn't really watch the product, and did a little bit of a detox from wrestling, because, you know, I had been let go. The Benoit situation happened, and then, you know, some time goes by, and you just can't help but get back into it.
During your times talking to Chris, did he ever act strange?
In fact, quite the opposite. I can tell you that of all the people there, Chris was the only one who regularly would fly his wife and kid out to the shows. So, I mean, I played with his son a few times when he'd be backstage, and, you know, talked to his wife several times. He frequently flew them out to be with him when he was on the road. And he was, from what I remember, the only guy who really did that. Some others may have done it, but not as frequent. So, and that's why I mean when I say he was the last person I would expect, because he's the guy that made the effort to have his family with him as much as possible. I mean, it's even tough for me to go back and watch the footage of him, you know, winning the heavyweight championship, and all the confetti comes down, and he brings his son in the ring and everything. I mean, it was just absolutely mind-bending that that happened.
What was your best storyline that didn't make it on TV?
Pitching an angle about the Four Horsemen. Because at that time, I knew that there were former Four Horsemen members that were either active roster or just on a Legends contract for the WWE. So I always, like I said, was a Flair fan, was a Four Horsemen fan. So I wrote about this Four Horsemen storyline. And WWE was releasing a Best of the Four Horsemen DVD set. And so that was kind of my opportunity to take my old, you know, knock the dust off of my old Four Horsemen idea and try to pitch it to actually use. And the concept was, you know, obviously, Mr. McMahon, Stephanie at the time was head of creative. She and Triple H were married and had a kid at that point. So they had already had that kind of McMahon-Helmsley leadership team firmly intact at that point. And, you know, Stephanie was in a real heel role at that time. Hunter's always kind of been, you know, a little back and forth between babyface and heel. But what I was pitching was, you know, they were really kind of becoming this oppressive regime. They were really pissing off a lot of the talent. Sorry, I don't know if you curse on your podcast or not. I apologize. And the likes of, you know, John Cena and different baby faces are just fed up, and they just want to take a stand. And then you hear, you know, woo, and out comes Flair, Arn Anderson, a road agent at the time. We had Chris Benoit. We had Tully Blanchard on a Legends contract, so he could be paid to make appearances. So we had former horsemen. They would kind of come out in suits, sunglasses, the whole thing, and basically they were going to be this high-powered management team, and they were going to make offers to the talent to come work for them, because they really couldn't get too physical. Rick was pretty old. Arn had a bad arm and couldn't really wrestle, but they could at least do this. And so then you would have this, you know, warring faction between the people who were loyal to the McMahons and the people who were going to go with the horsemen, and just set up some different drama that way. Well, I took it to Michael Hayes first, and he was kind of wishy-washy about it, probably because I wasn't pitching a Freebirds angle. But I then took it to Flair and bounced the idea off of him. And Rick loved it. And, you know, of course, he was all for it. Well, anyone who knows Vince knows that Vince doesn't tend to really give pushes to things that aren't his original product. The Four Horsemen were not his original baby, so he didn't, you know, really give it much consideration. The payoff for me, as the guy who wrote it and pitched it, though, was one night, it was Raw. Flair says, "Hey, kid, you know, after the dark match, you know, come take a look, you know, come jerk the curtain." So they had the main event for Raw. Flair was out there for a dark match. And when the dark match is over, Flair walks up the ramp, turns around, looks at the crowd, holds his hand up in the air. He walks back up the ramp, comes through the curtain, and just gives me like a wink and a nudge and a smile. And that was it. I was happy with that. Like, the fact that, you know, Flair was behind my idea and went out there and gave the Four Horsemen salute. The whole place popped. I considered that a win.
That's a great storyline. What about the Divas?
Before anyone obviously had ever heard of Becky Lynch, I really wanted to try to get a tough, kind of anti-hero female. Because again, you know, if you think about it, at the time, most of the female talent were, you know, we weren't that far away from the bra and panties match era of female wrestling. And I really wanted to give the female division a shot in the arm with just a really tough, you know, kind of badass chick. And I think we had some ladies at the time who could have pulled it off. But, you know, at that time, they were really just not giving the women that big of a push. They really just weren't. So I thought that at the time, for who we had, I really thought that more could have been done with Mickie James in that regard. She had the physical ability, she had the athletic ability, and we had, in my opinion, we had enough, like, just pretty bubblegummy type girls. You know, I thought we could really go for, you know, sort of like a female Steve Austin type lady. But to see it that way, and that got dismissed.
Who are some wrestlers you're trying to help creatively?
I can tell you, here's one that I knew was never going to happen, but another guy and I just came up with it one day, and we thought it was so funny that we just had to pitch it just to see what happened. Because, listen, Vince is the guy who signed off on the gobbledygooker. Anything can happen. I mean, Duke the Dumpster was a real thing, so we might be able to pull this off. We didn't, but I was really hoping we would. So, we had Eugene on the roster. Now, I don't really think you could get away with Eugene these days. You know, you can't marginalize somebody with a perceived mental health issue. But then, you could. So, oh, this is terrible, but we didn't care. So, we pitched the idea of what was called Eugenius. And Eugenius was, my friend John Schaefer and I were talking about this, and Eugenius would be Eugene, but he takes like a chair shot to the head or something, and it knocks something loose, and then he's actually quite brilliant. And it didn't go anywhere. The turning Eugene into Eugene was never panned out. But like I said, I've seen such crazy stuff that, hey, you know, you just got to pitch something and see how it goes. But, you know, I did try to come up with some good things for guys that really weren't getting too good of a shake at the time. Like, Paul Virgil. There was something creatively that I was trying to work on for him, because Paul was a good guy. He was a hard worker. Again, never complained, like, really good attitude. Like, Paul Virgil was the kind of guy that if you had given him something good, he would have done his best to run with it, and he just got handed creative piles of crap a lot. You know, kind of like Stevie Richards. Like, Stevie Richards was there at the time. Stevie Richards was a great guy, and Stevie Richards was a great worker, and he was very passionate, and, you know, you can give Stevie the worst gimmick, And he'll go out there and do his best to try to turn it into something great. I mean, right to censor, come on. So I was working with Stevie to try to come up with something good for him. And, you know, it's just, it's tough. It's tough because if you're not a draw, it's tough to convince Vince that you can be a draw with a little tweak. And I'll tell you one that did work, Chuck Palumbo's biker gimmick. I don't know if you remember that. But that was during my time there. And so this was post Billy and Chuck. And they wanted to use Chuck for something, but they didn't really have much. So I pitched making him more of like a, you know, just more of like a street tough character and basically the mirror opposite of his Billy and Chuck gimmick. And my idea was taken and it was kind of twisted and turned. And from what I could tell, it basically seemed like a rehash of Undertaker's American Badass gimmick, which was not really what I had intended. But I mean, I was happy that Chuck at least got a little bit of a push and, you know, got a little bit of work out of it, but it wasn't really what I intended. But I really enjoyed working with the guys that didn't get a lot of attention because, I mean, they were most appreciative. They were willing to do anything. They never complained. You know, like I said, the Chuck Palumbos of the world, the Paul Londons of the world, those are just great guys. I really enjoyed trying to do what I could for them, but you know, there's only so much room on the card. And when you got Cena, when you got Hunter, when you got Shawn, you got Dave, when you got all those guys, it's, you know, it was tough to find a spot for them, but that's the business.
Was there a wrestler that you had a preconceived notion of, but he turned out to be the opposite?
Chris Masters was there at the time, and, you know, for as much of a physical specimen as he is, and, you know, you would just assume that guy was a raging asshole, Chris Masters was a really nice guy, and again, never complained. It was just real, real personable and really nice.
What was a good storyline that got bastardized?
Oh, boy. God, now I gotta think. Oh. Actually, the Donald Trump Vince hair match. How that ended up going, because I can tell you that there were a contingent of creative writers who were really pushing hard and only wanted to do it so that Donald Trump could get his hair cut on TV, and that was the whole appeal of the story, was to shave Donald Trump's hair. And I cannot tell you because I was not in the room for that meeting. I don't know if it was Vince, I don't know if it was Trump, I don't know who, but ultimately, I put the cop on the show and it made the loophole saved, which to me was completely anticlimactic because the only reason you have a hair match is because it's Donald Trump, and because he has that Donald Trump hair, like, no one cares if Vince gets this haircut. It doesn't mean anything. So the original intent and the original flavor of that storyline, I thought, was completely lost by having Vince get his hair cut. Like, to me, it means nothing at that point. Because, I mean, think about it. You've got Donald Trump, not the president, you know, obviously at that time, but still very big celebrity, had all of his, you know, apprentice, you're fired, all that stuff. Very well known for his hair. And now you're setting up this hair match. In my opinion, everybody's expecting Vince to lose because they would never think that Trump would let his head be shaved. And then you actually do that. I thought it would have been awesome. A bunch of us thought it would have been awesome. Again, that was the whole point of even having the hair match. But ultimately, in some discussion that was behind closed doors and we were not a part of, that didn't happen. I think it would have been so much better if Trump would have had his head shaved. I think we could have gotten so much more out of that story. Like I said, by having Vince get his hair cut, to me, it was just not much of a payoff.
How was John Cena with you?
John would pretty much go for whatever. He was a big practical joker. He was always pulling pranks behind the scenes. And for me, the thing that really was that really cemented my opinion of John Cena was we were at State College, Pennsylvania, and I had my father and my sister come out. I got them tickets and passes for that show. So we're backstage in catering, and I think we were chatting with Matt Hardy at the time. And, you know, my sister, who I was like a teenager at the time, she really wanted to meet John Cena. I told her, listen, he's really busy. He always has a lot of things going on. I don't know if you're going to be able to. But I went and I found John, and I just hated even bothering him. But I just said, hey, John, you know, I'm really sorry to bug you. This is my hometown. My dad and my sister are back in catering. You know, is there any way that, you know, you could just come back and just do a quick hello? He immediately stops what he's doing, walks back with me, comes over, introduces himself, you know, to my dad and my sister, you know, signing autographs, and probably spent 10 minutes just sitting there, just chatting with them, you know, just being personable. And I mean, for John Cena, you know, getting 10 minutes of his time backstage is, you know, that's a big deal, because there was a lot of demands put on his time back then. But the fact that he stopped what he was doing and came back and spent 10 minutes to talk to my family, told me everything I needed to know about the guy. So yeah, like, love him or hate him, I have nothing but respect for John.
Were there discussions of turning him into a bad guy?
Never one that I was in, even though I really wanted to. You know, I figured, I mean, he would get, you know, that Kurt Angle heat, where Kurt Angle would come out and he's, you know, smiling and, you know, the Olympic music and everybody's yelling, you suck, you suck. In my opinion, Kurt worked much better as a heel than a babyface. And I thought that, you know, I thought that John could really, really pull heat as a heel. But, I mean, I don't know what it is. I don't know what Vince's process is. But I look at people like John, I look at people like Roman Reigns, and it's like they're babyface run just gets shoved down your throat. I am going to make you like this guy as a babyface. And sometimes I think, you know what, just if that's the natural flow of things, then just make him a great heel. Like, some people are just really easily and organically over as babyfaces. Some people aren't. I never felt like John was one of those people that was organically over as a babyface. I feel like it really took a lot of time, a lot of work, a lot of effort to get people to kind of warm up to him. And even then, there was always a large, you know, negative reaction from a lot of people in the crowd when John comes out. I mean, you think about, like, you put John Cena in the ring with The Rock, Stone Cold Steve Austin, and Hulk Hogan together. Who's getting the least amount of cheers? It's going to be John.
Do you remember a talent getting a bad storyline as punishment?
I can tell you one guy who really didn't like his gimmick and really pushed hard to get it and wouldn't, and he was not particularly popular with the higher-ups, was Domino. Because we had Deuce and Domino, and again, the tag division was not very strong at that time, which was a bummer for me, because, like I said, I grew up Road Warriors, Heart Foundation, Freebirds, Midnight Express, like that era of great tag teams. I really wanted to be able to do something strong with our tag division. We just didn't really have it. I figure at that time, you know, the belts were kind of going back and forth between London and Kendrick and Deuce and Domino. But Domino, oh man, again, nice guy. I don't, nothing against him, but he wanted to go solo, and he really wanted to be this, like, street kind of hip-hop gangster kind of guy. And he had his old manager from, I think, OVW that he had come record and cut a black and white promo with him. And it was just bad. He pitched it, and it just basically got shut down. And it was like, nah, put the grease in your hair, put your blue jeans on, and go ride in the back of that 57 Chevy.
Did any of the wrestlers pull a rib on you?
The most memorable first meeting I had with any of the talent was Mark Henry. I'm up front, I'm at ringside, and I'm watching some of the talent rehearsing for their match. I don't even remember who was in the ring. And I was just kind of in the zone, not really paying attention to anything else around me. I'm just watching them go through the rehearsal. And I have not yet met Mark Henry. I feel a giant hand clap down on my shoulder. And I look over to the side, and right there, in my face, this giant head of Mark Henry. And he takes his breath and he goes, "Who are you?" And I said, "Hi, Mark, I'm George, I'm the new writer for SmackDown." And he leans in even closer and he says, "Do you like men, George?" Now, in my head, I'm thinking, he's probably just messing with me. But if he's not, I hope I'm faster than him, because if he gets a hold of me, I know I can't fight this guy off. So he says, "Do you like men, George?" And I said, "Well, not in a romantic way, Mark." And then he gets so close that his lips are almost touching my face, and he goes, "Oh, you will." And then his big grin goes on his face, and he goes, "I'm just fucking with you, man," and shakes my hand, and it was all good. But that's how Mark Henry chose to introduce himself to me, by vaguely threatening me with man love. But that's Mark. He's a clown. Funny guy, though.
Do you recall a time somebody got fired for doing something dumb?
This guy was one of Paulie's guys. He was skating on thin ice, and then he made the decision one night over drinks to tell John Cena that he had more street cred than him, and that was it. Pack your stuff. You don't go to the top babyface in the company and insult his street cred. So, yeah, it was, like I said, it was a pretty well-oiled revolving door for the creative team.
Did you ever get a phone call at 3 o'clock in the morning by Vince McMahon?
No, never did. If I was going to get a phone call at 3 in the morning, it would have been from Michael Hayes. Requests from Michael Hayes to run across the street to the liquor store and, you know, pick some things up, but that was about it. Hey, on your way in, stop across the street and pick up Michael's order. Now, when I say Michael's order, I'm saying Michael Hayes is the kind of drinker that went to the liquor store across the street. All you had to do is say, "I'm here for Michael's order," and they knew what it was and would put it together and give it to me. Creatures of habit.
What was Michael Hayes like to work with?
God, Michael. I can sum up working with Michael Hayes in one brief story. So, you know the expression, you've piqued my interest, or something has piqued my interest. Well, of course, it's not piqued, P-E-E-K or P-E-A-K, it's P-I-Q-U-E. So you've piqued my interest. So in a production meeting, Michael Hayes responds to somebody's idea and says, "You've piqued my interest." And there's a moment where everybody just stops and looks, and Bruce Pritchard finally breaks the silence and says, "Piqued? You mean Pete, you dumb fucking redneck?" Everybody, and of course Michael Hayes doesn't care. He's like, "Well, whatever the hell it is, piqued my interest." You know, Michael's a guy who has great knowledge of the wrestling business, and he has great knowledge of how to put together storylines, but he is not a detail kind of guy. Spelling doesn't count. Grammar doesn't count. You know, punctuation doesn't count. Michael is a big picture, 40,000 foot view creative guy, and then the writers beneath him would be responsible for taking those big picture things and fine tuning them into something that was palatable and could be put on television. So yeah, you know, this is not a guy who is looking over your shoulder to to dot the I's and cross the T's. And one of the most garish fashion senses of anybody I've ever met in my life, Michael Hayes, he's a unique character for sure. And man, can he hold his liquor. I would not go toe-to-toe with him at the bar.
What about Hunter Hearst Helmsley?
Hunter is, you know, and again, he's one of those guys that everybody called Hunter. No one called him Paul. You know, he was just Hunter. And Hunter was very professional. He was very personable. One of the more surreal moments of my life was flying on the corporate jet with Vince and Steph and Hunter. And, you know, Steph and Hunter's baby, I'm like holding her in my lap, bouncing her on one knee while I've got my laptop on the other knee, taking notes. So yeah, Hunter was the kind of guy that, you know, would hand me his baby and, you know, let me play with her while we're on the flight.
And of course, Vince McMahon.
Production meetings, Vince would have a B-Tor protein bar and a Diet Dr. Pepper at his seat. That was part of the deal. Before production meeting, somebody had a D-Tor bar and a Diet Dr. Pepper sitting at Vince's seat. 9 out of 10 times, he didn't touch either one. So I can tell you that in my tenure on the creative team, I ate a good number of D-Tor bars and drank a good number of Diet Dr. Peppers, because otherwise they were just going to get thrown out.
So what led to your release from the company?
I ended up leaving because WWE had gotten into the movie business, and then they made a movie called The Condemned, starring Stone Cold Steve Austin. And the marketing wasn't very good for it. It didn't get promoted very well, and it lost a bunch of money. Vince walked in one day in production meeting, and he said, "Well, The Condemned is a veritable flop." And you could just hear sphincters tightening up all over the place, because everybody knew what that meant. It meant the company just lost a bunch of money, and they were going to recoup their losses somewhere. Well, one of the ways that they did that was by cutting junior people in different departments. And there were people from WWE.com who were let go, some of the junior staffers. And there was myself and a guy named Rick Garney. Rick Garney had worked for ESPN before WWE, and he and I were the two junior writers, and Michael PSAs brought us into his office and said, "Sorry guys, you know, you're low man on the totem pole," and that was it. You know, that's the thing. I don't think it's terribly difficult to become a creative team member. I think it's really difficult to remain one for a long period of time.
How can fans follow you on social media?
My Instagram, so I'm GRutherford138 on Instagram. I actually just, on my story, I took your story talking about tonight and put it out there as well, so anybody who wants to hit me up can find me there.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me and tell me all these great stories.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure. It was a wonderful time. I really enjoyed it. I love being able to peel back the curtain a little bit. I know, as a wrestling fan, that's always what I wanted to know most about, is what was happening behind the scenes. And you know, it was a great time. It's a great business. I really hope that, like I said, that we get into a new renaissance era of pro wrestling. And I just enjoy talking with other like-minded people, especially people like yourself who are such a fan of the older stuff like I am. As much as I loved what I was doing at the time, my favorite part about the job was talking to the old-timers, talking to Sergeant Slaughter, talking to Dusty Rhodes, talking to Ric Flair. For me, that was the real highlight. So I, you know, please keep doing what you're doing. I love seeing your Instagram posts, but you know, I read everyone that goes out. If you know, you ever want to do a follow-up and chat some more, by all means, reach out. I'd love to talk again sometime. get me on a tangent, I'll go all day. But no, I appreciate it. It's been a real pleasure.
All right, sounds good. You take care.
You too, brother. Thank you.
City fair, O Dawn. talking.